Good morning, guys. This is Brandon from the Value Hive podcast. We're on episode 23. It's a Monday morning. We're recording this episode. I have the pleasure of speaking with Bill Brewster of Solimar Capital Group. Bill is prolific on Twitter, and you may know him from the Value After Hours podcast with him and Tobias. And who's the third guy there?
Jake Taylor,
yeah. So the three of them do an awesome podcast, just great content, and I've been looking forward to getting Bill on. We're going to talk a lot about managing through a crisis, Bill's philosophy on investing and kind of how that shifted over time, as well as looking back over his blog posts and kind of fleshing out some of these ideas of admitting mistakes and thoughts on overall valuation. So Bill, without further ado, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. As you were talking, I was thinking about the last time I looked at my blog, and almost everything that I've written up has been a massive loser, which is fun.
Well, we're going to get right into it.
Yeah.
So before we kind of dive into some of the intro questions, just for those that don't know, who are you and how did you get started in investing, and kind of who is Bill Brewster?
So I used to be, I have an interesting, I guess, path to this whole thing. I went to law school, knew I didn't like that, got heavily into options trading, being in Chicago, and I really, really like that part of the market, but realized that, it probably wasn't going to be the best for my personality fit. I saw myself potentially going down some dangerous quasi-gambling holes, and I was like, all right, I don't know that options trading is really the right lifestyle choice for me.
Right.
I did start a franchise. I tried to sell floors in the middle of 2009, which was not the easiest thing to do. Worked at that for 15 months, and eventually saw the writing on the wall. It was one of those situations where, like, even if I could turn it around, at that point, the business was so undercapitalized that I wasn't going to put more money into it. I had sort of hit pretty close to what I thought was a max loss, like a reasonable, I gave this thing a shot,
right,
number. And I figured, okay, well, if I just try to dig myself out of a hole outside of some sort of capital raise, which doesn't make much sense, I could have like a, you know, $45,000 to $50,000 a year paying job, which for the effort is just not worth it, right?
So right.
Worked with the franchisor. They were good about, you know, helping me get out of the agreement. And I think we both parted on relatively good terms. And after that, I had my grandma's friend, who I've known my whole life, sent me three books, and two were Bogle books and one was The Intelligent Investor. And The Intelligent Investor, I just fell in love with. And the sort of the funny thing about it is that guy knows Bogle, and he was trying to get me to, or knew, was trying to get me to go the Vanguard route. But I was like, I don't know, John, you sort of like snuck
you know, in The Intelligent Investor.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't know why you did that. You could have just omitted it. So anyway, I did not start. I mean, I started to pay attention to investing as if you owned a business at that time. But I didn't. I had probably a 12-month break between I had gotten hired by BMO Harris Bank. They had a credit analyst training program. And the way that their program worked, I needed to take some time between when I shut the franchise down and when I started the analyst program, just the way the calendar works.
Okay.
And I said, that's fine. And I basically used the break to just read everything I could about investing. You know, and it started with like contrarian investment strategies and a lot of value studies. Obviously, I found Toby's work during that period. And I started down the path of sort of, you know, believing in deep value. Went to BMO for 5 years. I got my CFA designation during that. And I had sort of talked to my wife throughout the process. And I said, look, I really want to do investing. She's an attorney. So, you know, worst case scenario, she could work a little bit more and provide. I'm fine having a sugar mama. And, you know, she sort of, I mean, once I got in the CFA designation, she sort of said, like, you've proven to me that you care enough about this to go give it a shot. Right. So I'm a guy giving it a shot. And I think the benefit of that is some of the flexibility. And, you know, the downside is I've always, always, always performed better in groups than alone. Hmm. And I think that's probably why I'm on – well, I do know. That's why I'm on Twitter so often. I've met a pretty incredible group of people between that and Manual of Ideas as a community. It's been a heck of a network to fall into or to work my way into, whichever way you want to say it. But I don't think I could be doing what I'm doing in a different time period.
Hmm. Yeah, no, we're definitely going to dive into that. And I kind of want to know how your investment style has shifted. So you said you kind of started out deep value with Tobias's stuff. And I also want to know kind of when you started getting in contact with Tobias and, you know, that whole dawn of the Value After Hours podcast. But how has your investment style drifted or shifted over the past, you know, call it since you started saying, look, hey, you know, I'm going to give myself a shot. You know, what's that path look like?
Yeah, so I think that I believe in the behavioral arbitrage, for lack of a better term, that deep value gives market participants. I personally think that arbitrage can be exploited much better through someone like Toby and his vehicle, which is structured as an ETF. So it can also roll out on a tax advantage basis.
Yep.
So I found that I have made decent money on some deep value ideas. For example, Nordstrom was one over the past year that, I mean, I made a fair amount of money. If you look at that chart, though, you know, I was fighting a trend from the top left-hand corner to the bottom right.
Yeah.
And, you know, with COVID-19, who knows where the chart ends up. But it's a brand that I understood, and I thought I think it was objectively selling at a really, really distressed price at the time that I had bought. That said, I have started to focus more on businesses where I think that the underlying business is growing, and part of the reason that I'm more comfortable with that, other than the fact that it's just easier to live with, is I think that your agency costs are much more reduced and probably aligned in those kind of businesses. And the biggest knock that I would have on some of the public companies is, like, I bitch about management pay a lot. But the flip side of that coin is, like, you can't run a baseball team and not pay your stars.
Yeah.
So the question is, are you paying the right star? Right. So, like, I'm a Cubs fan. We signed Soriano. That was terrible, you know, and we had to live through that. And I think that you can get that in investing also, but, you know, you pay the right guy and they can deliver a lot of results.
Yeah. And it's also interesting just to kind of use that baseball analogy. Cause I'm a Nationals fan. So this last year has been pretty cool for me.
Yeah. But and you guys let go of Harper and it worked out.
Yeah.
That was nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Screw that guy and his eye makeup.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, kind of the whole theme is this whole idea. And one of the questions I've always wondered in terms of, like, CEO pay and stuff is, you know, I guess you have to create for yourself a sort of standard or, like, a stats page, like a baseball card where you turn over and you can see, okay, this guy's batting 350. He's averaged 350 for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. He's got 20 plus home runs. Like, you can see it and it's kind of crystal clear, like, this guy's a star player. But for CEOs, it's a little bit different because the metrics aren't as standardized across the board. There's different industries. And so how do you measure, like, the overall, call it, star performance worthiness of a CEO and then reflect that in what you think they should be paid?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question, right?
Right.
So I think of it as, I mean, I follow Liberty because of Charter, and I follow Charter because, one, I knew of John Malone, and two, I was smart enough to surround myself with people like Francisco Oliveira, my boy Alex, Chris Sazlay. So Chris, who writes under Find Me Value, had a weekend at Stream Song golf tournament. I found all these guys on Twitter, you know, and Chris and Connor Leonard came out and they said, you know, we're doing a weekend. Anybody that wants to come, we're going to play some golf. And then, you know, at night we're going to have an investment discussion. And then, you know, after that, we'll sort of hang out and whatever. Right. And, you know, that weekend sort of like changed my life because I think I probably would be really focused on cigar butts now if I didn't at least have my eyes open. And the other thing Connor said to me is we were talking about my portfolio, and at that time I was still too nervous to take the training wheels off. So I was following some guys into some positions, you know, and sourcing ideas on 13Fs, which I don't think is a bad idea per se, but the reasons that I will now get into something like are much more reliant on myself and much less deferential to the work that other people do.
Right.
You know, like I guess when I was young or earlier in this, I'd be like, well, I don't really, Hertz is a great example of the stupidest thing I ever did. You know, Icon is in Hertz.
Yeah.
I know for a fact that I am more in touch with the public transportation market than Carl Icon. You know, the amount of times that I think he's using Uber and flying public and, you know, renting a car, I know I'm doing it more often.
Yeah, it's a good point.
And despite that, I was still like, well, Icon's got to see something, right? And I saw the asset base at the airports and I understood all that. I get the, you know, you have the relationships with big corporations, all that's nice. But like fundamentally, I was like, yeah, but Uber is going to kill all this stuff.
Right.
And I still let myself get talked into it. Thankfully, I went to Berkshire. I don't even know what year this was. It was either 2015 or 2016. And I felt like the car rental agencies were really ripping me off. So I was like, I'm just going to Uber everywhere this weekend. And then I followed that up by going to Denver and didn't have to rent a car there.
Yep.
And if you don't have to rent a car in Denver, you really don't have to rent a car because that airport is in the middle of nowhere.
Oh yeah. Yep.
And then I just asked myself, what are you really doing here? You know, are you following somebody or are you not? And long story short, Connor just sort of said like, take the training wheels off. And, that was a very good conversation for me to have. I don't know exactly if I'm still answering your question, but I think I am.
Yeah, no, I think you are, but I think it's going down a kind of a cooler conversation, which is the idea. I was just talking to Alex, you know, co-founder of MacroOps last weekend, and we were saying, you know, all these people that are trying to follow Buffett into these trades, they don't understand that the deals that Buffett's doing, like, you know, us, you know, normal investors can't necessarily get some of these deals. So it's also this idea of, you know, sure, they might be, you know, bullish on this company, but the underlying deal structure that they have in place and the reason that they're in that deal could be totally different. Like Buffett's out there getting, you know, 8% preferreds, you know, where the other people are just saying, oh, he's long XYZ. But it's just a totally different structure.
Yeah, well, this is like the most recent example that I have is I was talking to Francisco Oliveira about the Formula One tracker stock that Liberty Media has, right? And the Live Nation was a problem for that tracker because Live Nation and Formula One are very correlated assets right now. They're both basically plays on live events.
Yep.
And they both had a lot of leverage on them. Live Nation still does. And we were discussing the merits of Live Nation as a direct investment, and Francisco was like, dude, I don't know, man, because Maffei has the 33% interest through Liberty Media. He's chairman of the board. Like, if you want to play Live Nation, I think the better way to do it is go through Liberty, because then you get sort of the optionality of what Liberty Media might be able to do. And, you know, it's just a good example of surrounding yourself with the right people, having the right conversations, and trying to figure out the structure and incentives of everybody involved. You know, we'll see if though how it all worked out is Formula One sent Live Nation to Liberty Sirius, and Liberty Sirius sent some cash. How it all turns out is a separate discussion, but whether or not setting yourself up on the right side of the trade, you know, is important. And I couldn't agree more. I think what we were talking about is assets and management teams. And I guess that what I'm trying to focus on more and more and more is, do I understand this fundamental asset? Do I understand the strategy? And do I understand the managers that are playing the strategy? A good example of one that I was probably made some money on for the wrong reasons, and I'm sure some longs are going to hate me for saying this, but like Discovery Communications,
okay,
is one that I was long a while ago. I bought more around the same time that Malone bought. He definitely influenced some of my decision making, yeah. But also that stock was like really cheap a couple years ago. And my thesis was, well, the bundle's got a lot longer tail, and Discovery doesn't make much money out of it, so, you know, whatever. Now I sort of see it as, like, Discovery is inevitably dead, and Netflix is going to kill it. So can you extract the cash out of it in the meantime? And then I think the problem that I have with this, and I think on our Value After Hours podcast, I think I upset people when I talk about, like, GraphTech or GameStop or Taylor Brands or like any of these.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people can make money in that game.
Yep.
But I have competing thoughts here. One is, eventually the market will value a business at the value of the business, right? Because private equity or somebody comes over the top of you and ends up buying it out.
Right.
The other side of it is, minority interests in businesses are worth what minority interests can get out of a business. And if you're betting on a melting ice cube and you don't control the capital allocation, it's not in the CEO's incentive structure in almost any of these cases to distribute the money to you.
Right.
So I think in a lot of these situations, people are playing a flawed, like they're applying a very smart idea in a flawed manner. And I just think that you can watch these guys erode all the value under your feet and say, well, why? And the answer is incentives.
Yep. Yeah. No, I think it's so great. I mean, GraphTech was one that I was burned by. I bought in, took a loss, saw that Monish Pabrai was in it, saw that he bought more. But it is one of those things where it's, you know, it's a melting ice cube. And just because a company's trading at, you know, 2x free cash flow and it's going to get, you know, its market cap and cash flow the next 5 years, it doesn't mean that those insiders and those management teams are actually going to return that cash back to the shareholders.
Yeah. And look, they may. I mean, the GraphTech story is still really, really early. But what I never got comfortable with is those contracts are only as good as your counterparty risk.
Yeah. Which now, they saw some roll off.
Yeah. And look, I mean, you know, if it's essential to the industry and your contracts weren't egregious, then you can probably re-sign them. I get it. But it's just, I don't think that's the game that I really feel like playing with, you know, money that's mine. Right. Like I don't have a fund that has some upside downside skew that's favorable if I hit a home run. I mean, this is dollar for dollar risk for me.
Yep.
And I just, it's not really what I want to play.
Yeah, and that's actually exactly where I want to go next in this conversation, is the idea of managing through a crisis. It's one of the things that both of us wanted to talk about, and I'm going to use your last, I don't know if it was your last blog post, but one of your most recent ones. I'm going to use this kind of as a springboard, and then you can kind of take away with it. You said, people will criticize me for style drift. I believe this was about the airline, so we can get into all that as well. You said, people will criticize me for style drift. I could care less. My job is to make sure this family's wealth escapes this period intact. As a reminder, wealth is not a number. It is relative purchasing power, which I think is important. People will accumulate more wealth than we will by seeking distressed assets and being right, yes, but we will survive. Survival is our most pressing concern. So just talk to us a little bit about the idea of survival being the most important thing above, you know, what you call these asymmetric risk-reward opportunities.
Yeah, so I, like, in late February, early March, really high graded my portfolio and sort of abandoned a lot of the ties that I hold dear to value. So, I mean, for one, like IAC got to a point where it was a stub of what you were left with post the spin. It was trading like below the cash value of the stub. And they recently wrote a letter that highlights that. You know, is Match an asset that I think is a value, like a traditional value asset? No, right? But is it a business that I think has demonstrable network effects and is almost certainly going to grow as the population ages and benefits from divorce rates? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, is that insane to get a 4% free cash flow yield or whatever it was trading at the time on it? No, I don't think it really is that insane. And I think that when you, like, when I think of an asset like that, that's an asset that I really could own for 10 or 15 years comfortably. And you've got, in IAC, proven allocators. I think the CEO is probably going to do a good job. I am not as well versed on that particular asset as I, you know, as some other people, and I need to sort of get up to speed on it. But for me, like, whatever valuation bleed you're going to have, so say it, you know, goes from a 4% free cash flow yield to 6. I mean, that's big. It's not nothing. You know, it's offset by the earnings growth, and the longer that you take, the longer you hold that, the less per annum that valuation bleed has against you.
Right.
And the other thing is, like, I get thinking, well, what's a world where it trades at a 6% free cash flow yield? You've got a high ROIC business. It's probably going to grow. I mean, like, that's worth a lot more than the average business. So in that world, the average business is trading at a, you know, I don't know what, 8 to 10% free cash flow yield. Like, there's going to be a lot of pain in that world,
yeah.
Regardless of where you're playing. So, to me, I almost think of that as like those bets. Asset allocation protects you. Like if you're really going to bet that the world is going to trade at a way higher cap rate, I think asset allocation is the only place you can hide. I don't think that like a particular equity is going to save you. But what I knew in late February, early March was that earnings and cash flow were in question for a lot of these really like marginal businesses.
Right.
And that was the risk that I was unprepared to hold. So I said, okay, well, right now, my immediate risk in some of these names is valuation re-rating. If anything, I think that they're going to be viewed as more scarce because most businesses are scary right now. And I was just sort of early to rotate. Now I look at the portfolio and I have a lot of businesses that I don't necessarily want to sell. But
it's a good problem to have.
Well, we'll see. The value guy in me says, yeah, that's what everybody says before they get destroyed in these things, right? So there's definitely a tension between Gavin Baker said it on Patrick O'Shaughnessy's podcast, where he said, you know, in the beginning of a bear market, you get rewarded for doing the obvious. Later on, you start to get rewarded for doing the non-obvious things. I don't know that right now is the time that I am wanting to do the non-obvious things, although some stuff seems to be getting so cheap that it's probably going to be impossible not to at least rotate into some of it.
Yeah. So what are some of these non-obvious things that you're talking about?
To be honest, I don't know because I don't have like an active buy list, but I will tell you that. So things that are intriguing to me are the travel industry in general, right?
Right.
An asset like Vail, an asset like Disney, you know, those are probably more obvious than I'm thinking of. I am certain there's some value in small cap land that I should probably fish for. But given the path of the virus and the range of outcomes, I thought I knew the questions and the answers a month ago. Now I'm not even sure I know the questions.
Yeah.
I mean, the data is so mixed, and you know, I don't know. I don't know if this if the virus isn't as bad as people say, transmissibility wise, if the fatality is not as bad. You're also layering on human reaction to the virus, right? If you had told me last year there's going to be a virus that comes around and the entire world is going to choose to shut down because of it, it would not have been – I would have said no.
Yeah, right? That's not like, in your five-year DCF model.
I wouldn't even have fathomed it. And I said this about the airlines too. Like when I bought those, if somebody had – played a devil's advocate to me, because I tried to pre-mortem that, you know, right, and say like, how am I going to lose here? The notion of zero revenue for a or not zero, but 90% down revenue for an extended period of time, I would have told you you're insane. Yep. And then I would have said, well, you know, what's going to happen is the entire world's going to sell off. If you had told me that was going to be the outcome for airlines and the index would only be off like 10 to 15%, I'd have told you you're nuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I want to dive right in, you know, speaking of airlines, I know, you know, it's never fun to talk about when you're wrong, but
I don't care.
Yeah. But let's just kind of go right.
Talk about when they're right.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about, and you know, I don't really want to focus on, you know, your quote unquote mistake in airlines, but I want to talk about this kind of higher,
certain it was a mistake. I know the outcome was bad.
Yeah, but exactly. But the process is,
for instance, not to cut you off. Yeah, I would argue that me making money on Discovery was more of a mistake than me losing money on the airlines.
Exactly. Which, and
and
it goes back to the whole, you know, I don't know if you've read Andy Duke's book, Thinking in Bets. It's just this whole idea of following the process, not necessarily the N equals one outcome.
Yeah. But I have not read that. I hear it's good though.
Yeah, you gotta get your hands on it. It's really
I think
good.
Buffett's taught me most of it.
That's a good point. So just kind of shifting to the power then to admit mistakes, because this is one of the things that I always like to talk about is, you know, the idea of there's this dichotomy between, you know, having this extreme confidence in your abilities to, you know, find bargains and to invest in companies that will do better over the next, you know, 5-10 years than other people. But you also have to contrast that to the extreme humility that you have to have and say, look, I am wrong. And, you know, so how do you juggle between this dichotomy when you go through your investment process and realize, you know, like, hey, I have to have confidence, but I also have to realize that I can be wrong.
So I guess that I don't ever try to have extreme confidence in anything. I try to be calm about how I'm thinking, and I try to be confident in what I'm doing, but I don't have extreme confidence in much. So I used to play a lot of golf as a kid. I played competitively. I guess how I would say it is I try to get myself in the right mindset where if I'm on the tee box, you know, I can see the fairway and hit it into the fairway.
Right.
I try not to hit it at a certain trajectory through the trees so that I hit the perfect shot, right? So there's like a balance between what I think I see and what I think the market sees. But I also the quote that rings out a lot for me is Adam Robinson. He's under I Am Adam Robinson on Twitter. Had a couple interviews with he had one with Shane Parrish and two with Tim Ferriss, and the thing he said that really like shook me was he said, I look for opportunity in places that make no sense and things that are blatantly obvious, because those are the two areas that massive value creation can come out of. You know, where blatantly obvious, sometimes the consensus is really right and like you can just ride that wave. And makes no sense is totally bombed out and, you know, people aren't interested. So, you know, I guess to put that in context, like Twitter is blatantly obvious right now and energy is makes no sense. So is there, you know, how do you sort of play that interplay in your mind and balance those risks and whatnot? And I think it's, for me, just trying to think about what do I see here, what do I think the market sees here, and what are other bets priced at? And you know, I, as a one-man shop, I understand that I don't have a view on everything. And I think that's important. I mean, it can be tough to see on Twitter. I tweet a lot. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff I just don't know about. I mean, going back to GameStop and Taylor Brands, I don't know anything about that. Like, and you know what? I honestly don't want to. And right. That's going to create a lot of opportunity for someone. Yep. That someone might be Michael Burry. But it's just the amount of time that that would take to research and what I would need to know about. I mean, first of all, like, with GameStop, you're betting on inner mall traffic. I just don't like want to look myself in the mirror and be like, yeah, I lost to that.
right.
But, you know, so I have to focus on things where the knowledge base is leverageable in the future and I can compound the research because I don't have the team where and no one can afford to just throw away the money. But I can't send an analyst to go do deep work on GameStop to come back to find out, you know, I'm Bruce Berkowitz and Sears and, you know, whatever. So did I answer your question or did I go on a tangent?
I think you went on a tangent, but it's fine because your tangents. Apologize. No, it's fine. Your tangents actually spark questions that I have that I just want to follow up. So, you know, this idea of, you know, you're not trying to know everything and you're not even trying to, you know, pretend that you know everything or have confidence in anything. And I guess my next question is then, like, when you pull up that thread, is it just your personal interests in certain industries and sectors, or are you looking at it as, you know, we can kind of dive into your investment process here and talk about maybe sector rotation, asset allocation? Are you looking at a broad spectrum and saying, okay, I think this sector, this industry is going to do well, and you go into it that way? Or is it just, you know, you follow what interests you in a certain industry and then you go further?
Yeah, I think it's what I can relate to, and that turns into what's around my life and where I see opportunity. I mean, travel was one that I fundamentally knew, like, viscerally why it was continuing to grow. The data supported it. Where I placed the bet, I thought was mispriced, and I like the industry structure. I was obviously influenced by the fact that Buffett has taken a position because it made me scratch my head on why the airlines. But then once I dug into it, I was like, oh, this is actually what I think is actually, you know, a pretty genius bet. So, and then I try to find, if I get an industry that I'm interested in, I try to follow it through the value chain to figure out, okay, well, are there certain kinks? And in retrospect, I probably really should have opened my mind to something like TransDigm and Heiko way, way earlier than I did. I went basically through all the shit. I mean, I went from the airlines to, I liked GE for a while. I still do sort of like that asset base, but they got real problems.
Yeah.
I looked at Safran. I looked at Rolls, not like deeply, but, you know, I looked at them. And I always sort of looked at TransDigm and Heiko's multiples, and I said, well, I'm not interested in that anymore or paying that kind of price. And that's where I think, like, that Adam Robinson quote of saying, like, this doesn't make any sense, why do they trade at such high multiples, would have been a better question to ask myself than just seeing the multiple and saying, I'm not interested in that, it's too rich.
Yeah, yeah, and it goes back to the idea of, you know, just this quantitative value and how if you just screen for low PE or low EV to EBITDA, you're going to miss those ideas and then you're going to miss those that are actual, you know, value investments that might have a little bit of a rich multiple, but if you look out far enough and you know you can create a scenario where this thing takes over, then it's actually not that expensive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I do think that the thing that is, and the period that we're discussing right now is, you know, super unique. Hopefully I don't want to live through another COVID-19 every year.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, the pushback that I think is legit on something like TransDigm and Heiko is, if you are going to pay a very rich multiple, you have to be willing to hold for a very long time. If you are holding for a very long time, you're going to have some stuff like this happen. I mean, maybe not this, right? I mean, we're talking about far out on the standard
deviation scale,
curve
yeah.
right now, right? But it's possible. And there's a lot of things that are going to be crappy that occur to your businesses that are possible. I don't know if you saw Russo's recent letter or his results.
No.
But, man, one of the things that, like, stuck out to me, I'm going to try to find it real quick, is,
yeah,
I mean, you know, his ability to hold, right? His ability to turn MasterCard into the investment that he has turned it into, because he just I don't want to say it like he just doesn't do anything, because that's not the right way to frame it.
Right.
But I think it was Jake Rosner of Coho Cap told me that the ability to hold is a superpower. And I really think it is. I mean, just when you look at this MasterCard investment, cost base is $7.9 million, current value $93.5 million. You know, and I mean, and you don't pay taxes on that.
Nope. How do you develop, you know, this is obviously a mega question, but how do you think you even start to develop that ability or that superpower to hold?
I don't know. It's what I'm worst at.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at it. But, you know, I say that, and if I look back at it, you know, I bought LaCroix. LaCroix was probably, or National Beverage Corporation, Fizz. That was probably the first, that and Ubiquity were the two investments that really made me question whether or not I wanted to be like a deep value guy. Because both of those were situations that, LaCroix was personal use. Ubiquity was a friend that told me about it. They were both situations that had definitely not cheap multiples, but I could really see the growth path and really understand it. And given where they were trading relative to other assets, I was like, this doesn't make sense. And the free cash flow profile of both of those was attractive. I sold both of them almost at a double, both under a year. So not a tax advantaged way to sell. But you know, they got like pretty rich. And Ubiquity, I probably should have held. Well, I should have held. National Beverage, I shouldn't have. That was the right sell decision. So, you know, I don't know. Those are two that stick out. In general, selling has been a benefit to me. I worry that I'm learning the wrong lessons.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I can definitely vibe with that. I want to dive now into your investment process, kind of the soup to nuts. I saw your slide deck on RH, and you know, I just want to see, you know, we don't have to talk about that investment in particular, but I just kind of want to know, like,
I don't own it right now.
Okay, yeah. So let's talk about just in general. How does an idea go from, you know, incubation in your mind to part of your portfolio, and what does that look like for you?
Yeah, well, RH is actually a pretty fun one to talk about because I hated it. And I went on Twitter and I was like, this is BS. This guy's talking about he wants to be the next Hermes. Gary Friedman's his name. He's the CEO. And I said, you know, I grew up, my mom was an interior designer. She had a very, very big aversion to restoration hardware and mass produced furniture in general. And I thought it was total BS. I got on Twitter and some people that I respect said, like, you're missing this. And I figured, all right, well, I guess I'll dig. There was one person in particular that just kept pushing me and pushing me on it. And, you know, I said, all right, whatever, I'll look into it. And I put together that deck. I presented it to Manual of Ideas in January, mostly as, you know, this is what I think is going on. And I followed it, and then, you know, COVID-19 happens, and the business was selling at a pretty big discount to what I thought it's worth. I actually bought a little bit in, let's see, I guess this was early in the sell-off. It was at like roughly $120 a share was when I bought like my first shares. And then it got down to like in the 70s. I think it touched 77. And I bought more down there. And then, you know, sort of everything rebounded. And I guess that in retrospect, I don't even know if buying it was a mistake, because now I don't own it, so I clearly think it was. But given the facts at the time, I guess that I probably should have waited longer to just sort of let this situation develop. I think that what I probably erred on, or made an error in, is understanding the duration of this problem and the knock-on effects. I mean, I think the pitch for Restoration Hardware is people are going to be stuck at home. They're getting paid while they're working from home. They're going to pay. They're going to buy stuff to upgrade their home because they're not going to be paying for travel, like whatever. I'm at the point now where I'm like, at, you know, 50, well, let's call it 10% unemployment. Are people really going to buy luxury furniture? Like, is that really what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And I think in the beginning of this crisis, I figured that behavior wouldn't change as much as I think it may now. I don't think there's going to be permanent changes.
Yeah.
But I don't know that you want to bet on financial and operating leverage in a race against time.
Right.
So,
right.
So that's why I am uncomfortable with it. I think I probably underweighted the probability that it would be a zero earlier than I do now. That's what's changed.
So in a general aspect, you know, how do you find ideas, and then how do you go about doing your due diligence process?
A lot of it is just talking to people about what we're seeing. I mean, I think most of us on Twitter have an interest in media, so you're thrown a lot of media names.
Oh yeah.
Through cable, you have to follow wireless, so that's sort of interesting. I don't even know if I missed it. I don't know that I liked it, but like Inseego is a 5G name that, because I talk about cable, people popped into my feed and said, hey, have you looked at Inseego? I couldn't quite get my head around what made that company super unique. But, you know, that's been a real winner for some people. So it really is just discussing ideas with, you know, I mean, like Alex and Francisco are sort of my day-to-day who I share ideas with. And then, you know, you bounce around. That's become most of it. And then it's putting together, you know, all the research. And that's what takes a long time. And the opportunity cost in it sometimes is huge, right? So, like, I pitched AB InBev in December of 2018. Probably wrong on that one. Definitely wrong given the outcome. And I think that, you know, what COVID-19 might do to their business, they levered up to buy SAB Miller, combined the number one and number two player in the market, but they gained a huge amount of emerging market exposure. And that just makes me really nervous right now, given what I perceive the hospital systems to be and what I think could happen down there. So
how long does it take for you to, you know, I guess it probably depends by name, but like from, you know, when you start researching to when it's in the portfolio, like how long on average does that take? Or, you know, are some companies quicker or no?
I mean, some are way quicker. Certainly over this period, some have been real fast. It's stuff that I have followed for a while. Some of it I don't know that deeply. And in order to keep beta exposure and not own an index, I have hidden diversification a lot more than I normally do. My ideal portfolio, I've always said, is like 8 to 12 stocks. Right now I'm running 18.
Right.
Some of it, you know, so like I added Heiko and TransDigm to the portfolio. That was a pretty quick decision. Is that, you know, a quick decision, or is that on the back of 2 years of following the airlines pretty freaking closely and understanding what the trends are,
right,
and seeing where the value chain is?
Yeah.
So a lot of it's just coverage. Any new idea, I mean, it's going to take at least a month and a half, 2 months, I think, before you really get a sense of what's going on. And that's probably too short.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the idea of that whole story of Buffett being in the bathtub or whatever, and he just like was thinking about, I think it was American Express or no, it was Bank of America. And he just like thought about it and then just bought like a bunch of stock. I like that
idea.
Yeah,
so that idea for him is a life, right? That's his entire life has been financials.
Yep.
So did he make that decision in a bathtub, or did he make it over 60 years?
Yeah, it's exactly. It's this whole, like, you know, the whole idea of an overnight success takes, you know, decades. And it's like everybody just sees that one instance where you, you know, buy the stock or you hit that big sale.
Yeah.
Let's shift now to go ahead.
Just real quick, Nordstrom. Yeah, yeah. Like, that was one that probably took, I don't know, 2 years to develop, because I got interested in it when the family tried to take it over. And then it fell through, and then I just watched it, and, like, I don't know, it was just kind of always not that attractive. Then it got really stupid cheap, and I was like, all right.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, it's almost this idea of just keeping a Rolodex of ideas flowing through your head, and then it's, you know, compounded knowledge. You look back over 2 years, it's like, wow, you've learned way more just by, you know, knowing a little bit about each industry or a few companies. And then when an opportunity presents itself, like, you know, let's say COVID-19, you're able to act quickly.
Correct.
It's you know, it's a great asset and a great mindset.
And what I want to start to do is stop filling my pipeline with things like Cleveland Cliffs and GraphTech. And, you know, and I don't mean that, like, pejoratively to the people that do it. I'm really not trying to be rude.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't want that to be my pipeline anymore. I want it to be Booking and LVMH and Hermes and all that stuff. And I want to know when they are trading at a discount to what they normally trade at and not what looks optically expensive. Because, you know, to put it in real estate context, you're not going to buy Class A real estate in Chicago for the same price that, you know, some random single family in Memphis costs. Yep. So I am focused, or have been in the past, a lot on the Class C in Memphis more than the Class A. And, like, I want good assets for my family.
Yeah. No, it's actually funny, this idea of real estate, because I had Moses Kagan on the podcast,
who's a good guy.
He is awesome. And it's you know, this idea, and I might want to go down on a little bit of a real estate allegory tangent here, because I think real estate's such a great example for people that don't necessarily, you know, have the physical sense of, you know, what share ownership means in a business.
Yes.
And, you know, from personal experience, it's, you know, as a deep value investor at heart, you know, someone who's, you know, looking for these 50, 30 cent dollars, a perfect example is the real estate market in Baltimore. And, you know, it's like you can find these, you know, row homes, these townhomes, multifamily complexes that are trading, you know, at 10, 12, 13% cap rates, which is great in a model, and it's great in a spreadsheet, and you can do your financials and be like, wow, I can leverage this thing and I can make a ton of cash. It's like, yeah, that's great. But, you know, perfect example, I saw one that was like an 11% cap rate. I was like, you know, I'm going to drive through this thing. This looks nice. Let me just do a drive by. Didn't get out of my car. I was just like, it's
collect rent.
Exactly. And it's like, yeah, sure, it's cheap, but if no one wants to buy it from you, or if no one wants to live there, or, you know, no one wants to, you know, actually use the asset that you're purchasing, it doesn't matter how cheap it is. And real estate's just such a good, tangible example of that.
So the quote that I think has messed me up, or I have misinterpreted more than many, that Buffett has said is when he's like, if you want a 10% return and you pay $100 billion for a business, it needs to return $10 billion to you. And if it doesn't return $10 billion this year, it needs to return, you know, 11.1 the following year, and so forth and so on. I think that that's a very good illustrative example of how you should think. But there is also an argument to be made that I think is very reasonable, that if you are paying a low enough cap rate relative to where it should trade, whether it's real estate or you just call a cap rate on a stock a multiple, as earnings grow, your probability of that cap rate compressing, right, or the, your multiple going down is lower. So it is possible to make your 10% through price appreciation. It is potentially a riskier game, and there are fewer ways out, right? You can only realize it by sale.
Yeah.
So there's an argument to be made that maybe it's less safe. I would buy that. But the idea that you can't make money, or that people don't make money that way, is, like, very flawed. And it's something that took me a while to understand, that, like, they're betting on terminal value expansion is not speculation as much as I thought it was.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's great. And that's why, like, I like, I don't know if you read Scott Miller's letters from Greenhaven, but he, you know, he always talks about, you know, we want to win through multiple ways, you know, multiple expansion, margin expansion, you know, price appreciation. And it's just, you know, finding, you know, you don't have to just win through a stock going. I mean, you can make a ton of money if a stock goes from 2x EBIT to, you know, 5x EBIT. You can make a ton of money doing that, but you can also make a ton of money where the stock goes from, you know, 20x EBITDA to 22-23x EBITDA, but it's growing that cash flow by 25% a year.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's go down now to just kind of how you think about valuation, because I know we've kind of kicked the ball around on kind of, you know, how you think about valuation and buying stocks, you know, discounts and stuff. So what does your valuation process look like? Has it gotten simpler over the years? And, you know, if you don't use like a DCF or something and you do a multiple valuation, you know, why do you choose, you know, kind of which instrument you use?
Yeah, I do like a back of the envelope DCF. I usually will just model like PP&E is a percentage of sales and net working capital is a percentage of sales, right? So I'll write out the income statement, and then for my balance sheet, I usually do like PP&E as a percentage of sales and the working capital, because that should give you the cash usage. And then you got to think through, okay, well, you know, are there going to be any efficiencies or inefficiencies that come out of this? So for like RH, I think you could make a mistake if you look at the working capital improvement that they have made over the past 2 years and you extrapolate it into the future. I think you're probably going to overstate cash flow, because a lot of the improvements that they made to the business are sort of like one time in nature.
Right.
You know, whereas somebody like 3G, when the virtuous cycle was running in 2016, you know, people would have argued that it could be continuous. But that's a good lesson in and of itself, that, you know, nothing can go on forever. So, you know, I basically just try to get to cash, you know, cash in the door. And then I will pay a lot more if there is no debt on the business than if there is, because I view that as, you know, a potential recap is another margin of safety. So that's more or less how I do it. I mean, we can go through, you know, more nuanced, you know, things for Restoration Hardware, since you sort of gave me the T-ball on this would be the one that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, like they're guiding to 10-12, I think, percent sales in the long term growth. I am not comfortable modeling 10-12% growth in a like a luxury furniture brand. Right. I can understand why they think it, but like, so I modeled closer to like 5-8% for different scenarios. Gives them some credit for outgrowing GDP and capturing some market share, but not as aggressive as they are.
Right. Now, how optimistic will you get on a company's, you know, projections over the next, you know, call it 5 years? And then I guess, you know, how far do you project those cash flows? And then do you think that there's a, you know, too far length where if someone's doing a 10-year DCF, you just think that, you know, is that kind of, you know, just pointless to do it that far out?
Yeah, well, I think like most of the people, I think even Dorsey would say, like, you know, the purpose of the DCF is more to think through how the business works, who can enter, how can you actually take value out. I mean, that's like for the working capital and the PP&E, right? Like, are you, now I say PP&E and I think of like personal protection. Yeah. Things have really changed.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But you know, like just thinking through, can they optimize their distribution? And so like Ollie's is one that I looked at a little while ago, right? They've got a distribution warehouse coming on in Texas. So if you were to model that business, you have to understand how sales are going to start to flow through that distribution center and when they may need to open the next. But, you know, you got to think like 10 years out, when do they need their next one? But the precision of it is sort of BS, right? Like you don't know how the business is going to develop. But if you're not having the thought, then you're ignorant. So
yeah,
I just think, you know, it's that kind of thing is an art. And then I think you just try to mitigate the risk of the precision risk by paying a low enough multiple that you don't have to be that precise.
Yeah. Do you have Do you,
or
you
know, evaluation? I shouldn't say multiple.
But. Yeah. Do you have like a specific, you know, I guess do you put collars on how much you're willing to pay for certain businesses? It sounds like, you know, I guess in the non-traditional value, it's not like, you know, it's not like you're saying I'm not going to pay more than, you know, 15 times.
Yeah.
EBITDA or something. How does that work?
I like to look at how an asset is traded and how the comps are trading. I mean, I do look at that a fair amount, like historical valuation over the past 5 years versus comps and versus itself. And then I try to understand what's changed over the last 5 years that maybe is driving that. I'm definitely more inclined to buy things when they are on the lower end of that, you know, I guess spectrum, for lack of a better term. The risk there is something changed that I don't really understand.
Yeah. I want to go now. One of your blog posts that was just really, really good. It was the book recap of capital accounts.
Oh, which, yeah, those guys are beasts.
Yeah, I went through that, and I'm actually, you know, I'm probably gonna pull out and do a thread on those things. But one of the quotes that I kind of want to highlight here, it's just a good wrap on this whole philosophy of growth and valuation. From the article, it goes, quote, "Importantly, companies with long runways and low risk growth paths are worth a higher multiple than those lacking those characteristics. However, just as oaks don't grow to the sky, multiples eventually reflect unrealistic expectations. The investor's job is to avoid the pitfall of believing hype at exactly the wrong time. Watch out for leading indicators of falling profitability, industry expansion, lower returns on capital, and accounting gimmicks that keep earnings elevated. These are all warning signs, and demanding valuations require few warning signs." And so my question with all that is, you know, how are you looking for, you know, whether a business is actually growing because of the, you know, operations, or if, you know, like this, you know, kind of quote said, there's some accounting gimmicks going on and the business is actually deteriorating and that multiple isn't worth as much?
Yeah, well, I think that top line sales is more valuable than bottom line EPS growth. I know Nygren recently said that he doesn't agree with that, and I'm not gonna like go toe to toe with Bill Nygren. That guy's a monster. But I do think that sales are harder to juke than earnings. Gross profit is harder to juke than earnings. You know, it's I mean, this is the tension with everything, right? So how much of the S&P can big tech make up before it either eats it or gets destroyed? And I don't know the answer to some of these questions. I mean, it's always easy in retrospect to say, oh, man, you fell for the fact that Amazon was an octopus, you know, eating the world, you know, like that model my man Sarab Madan put out of the, like, the different tentacles and how it's using different cash flow to grow different business lines. Like, maybe it is the time that Amazon, this is peak optimism for them. The other side of it is, like, I think that they're growing their cloud business at you know, unlevered returns on capital between 25 to 27%. It's growing at 30% a year. Like, I mean, what's that worth? It, yeah. It all depends on the runway, but I'll tell you what, there's only three companies that have the real possibility to capture it. So the bet then becomes like, you know, are they going to destroy all the economics for each other? How does that all work? I think the way that I think about it today is you understand the risk that you're taking and you watch those risks more than any other risk. And that's just what you got to do if you're going to play the high multiple game, because you get destroyed when these things re-rate for a reason.
Right.
Right. So if something that's that used to be valued on sales goes to an earnings multiple, you're going to get your face ripped off.
Right. Right. And, you know, before we kind of go into the concluding, you know, section and kind of last questions, you know, we're approaching the hour here. I want to finish by talking about one of your first, I think it was your first, yeah, your first ever blog post. It was about return on invested capital and growth. And there were so many gems in that thing. And so I'm gonna pull one quote again, and then I want to talk about, you know,
I like that there were a lot. I just try to put one gem.
Yeah, no, I found a lot. I found a lot of gems. So I'm gonna preface this whole section so that way you can think about it while I'm kind of saying this quote. It's the idea of incremental capital expenditures and free cash flow and how that affects over the next 5 years. So with that as the background, I'm gonna dive into the article.
Real quick,
yeah.
Dude that I have to credit for this, for putting this in my brain, is the guy that wrote Under Value Trap from Charlotte Lane Capital.
Okay.
He is the one that, when I was a youngin' on Twitter, was always hammering home incremental returns on capital employed. And a lot of people are doing it now. He was the one that I really, like, owe what I've learned to. Cool. So yeah. Important to shout him out.
Yeah, I got to follow. I haven't heard of him.
I think he disappeared from Twitter. I don't know why, but Charlotte Lane's his firm.
Okay. Cool. I'll see if I can find those letters. All right. So let's go right into the blog post. You said, "That said, there is nothing inherently superior to a steady state high return on capital business and a steady state low return on capital business. Why? Because if you are paying a multiple of earnings, then the income statement will already reflect the cost of depreciation and consequently your reinvestment rate, assuming the firm is well run in both firms. Therefore, the multiple you pay will be much more important to determine your success as an investor in a steady state firm. But, as you noted, we don't live in a steady state firm. So because of that, the importance of incremental capital expenditures and free cash flow over the next, you know, looking out becomes way more important than people think." So, you know, just kind of take it from there.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to have a conversation with my old self about that. I mean, you know, what is, if you are afraid of inflation, right, if that's your fear, depreciation and CapEx are almost certainly not going to match up, because the assets that you're replacing are going to cost a lot more than the assets that you're carrying on your book, which for me is part of the reason that one bet that I made, Visa got what I thought was stupid cheap here in this last sell-off. And one of my fears from all this money printing is inflation. I think it's almost certainly deflationary in the short to medium term, but long term I can understand. The nice thing about Visa is if inflation blows up, you got more flowing through their pipes, and that business requires no incremental capital. So it can all come back to you. Now, yep. How they do it, you know, we can quibble about they do it through buybacks or dividends. But if they do it through a buyback, you can sell proportionately and you know, get your dividend that way. So I would disagree. I would say today I would value the high return on capital firm higher than I would the low return. But it is true that I guess if you're replacing assets at your depreciation level, and you're not growing, right, then my statement would make sense. But growth throws all that into flux.
Yeah, no, but I think I just think the idea of, you know, everything can sometimes be construed as, you know, surviving in this steady state, but, you know, we don't. And if anything, this COVID-19 has shown us that, you know, there is no such thing as a steady state. And you just have to be willing to adjust and kind of change your models on the world.
Well, so, I mean, back to RH, you know, how did they achieve the ROIC that they have today? Well, they entered a lot of sale leasebacks, right? They don't own their real estate. They basically become more or less a brand. And, you know, they're pretty levered. So your equity returns are juiced by leverage. Is that more fragile? Yeah, probably, right? Is it optimal? Yeah, from a spreadsheet. But, you know, is that – I have questions after this crisis about whether or not you want to chase their ROIC in that way. You compare that to something like Match or some software company where the returns on capital are almost inherent to the business. Now, that's subject to what you have to pay your people and whatnot. So everything is sort of debatable, but that business is inherently better. And I think that is worth justifiably a higher multiple, assuming it's as defensible, which in that instance, I think network effects are very real.
Right, right. All right, cool. Yeah, so let's kind of dive into these concluding questions here. You know, we're going over the hour, and I know you're working from
home.
I'm
good with it if you are.
yeah. Let's
as
keep...
long as the listeners are still listening.
Yeah, let's just keep rolling with this. So
I crave human interaction right now. So we may never get off this thing.
Well, take us through. Actually, you know, let's kind of scratch these first few concluding questions. Let's kind of go ad lib here. What's it like, you know, being a father with kids working from home? That's you know, got the kids at home, but you know, most of your work is this deep work and trying to research and read and write about things. What's that been like?
This is going to be a very unfulfilling question or answer for you. I have spent a lot of time just being grateful that I can do this.
Yeah.
The real tragedy of this episode is what the service industry is taking under or going through, you know, and the people that can't. There are a lot of people out there that could not afford to have this happen to them, and yeah. It's happening. So my work is suboptimal, but my problems are none to cry about. Is more or less how I would say it. It's very hard to do deep work. Yeah. I've shifted to in the mornings now. My wife takes the kids, and in the afternoons I do, and it sort of gives me the morning to sit down and work, and that's been the most effective thing for us.
Okay, so what does a typical work day look like for you? How do you allocate your time?
A good one looks like I wake up at like 5:30. By 6:15, I have my coffee made and I'm in the office. And then, you know, I work until probably about 1. And then after that, you know, I'm sort of – my brain is more or less not turned off, but I can do stuff that – like I'll flip through the news at you know, 1 to 5 or whatever. But I find that I need to read the 10Ks in the mornings. It's the old, like, eating your vegetables thing.
Right.
I am much more effective early than I am late. So that's when I try to do the stuff that I don't want to.
So do you do, like, Andrew Walker, you know, he's doing, like, a 10K a day, or at least one 10K a day? I don't.
I need to, though. He's inspirational, man. That guy's
really
work ethic is like Jordan.
Yep.
Yeah. So I should do that. I probably will. I think I'll probably set my target at like 3 a week.
Okay.
The only thing that I caution against measuring yourself in that, and Andrew doesn't have to worry about this, but like, you know, there's certain 10Ks are harder to get through than others.
Mm, 100%.
So I don't want to like stat juke. but yeah.
So have you listened, and this is, you know, this is kind of fun to think about. Oswath Damodaran did a podcast with Masters in Business. I think it was Barry Ritholtz does that podcast, and he was talking about, you know, how to analyze a 10K. And for those that are listening that, you know, are just kind of getting started or whatever, Oswath has a great video on YouTube. Actually, he breaks down an entire 10K for you. And what would you say when you read through a 10K on average, like how much of it's just noise? And how much of it's useful, and how have you learned to just kind of cut through all the noise and get to what matters? Or do you just go A, first page, kind of Jeff Gannon, focus compounding, A to Z, and read through the whole thing?
I think I really like those guys at Focus Compounding, but if we were having beers together, I would have serious debate about whether or not that's the most effective use of time. I think read the audit, read the risks, and then if you want to read MD&A, I like MD&A, but it is corporate promotion, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The audit you can't BS, and the risk section is one that I used to way underweight, and now I think it's one of the most valuable sections in the 10K. You know, I don't know, starting at 1 and going through, it doesn't seem – look, if you want to own the business, you have to do that, right? But, like, if you're doing – work on an industry. So if you are researching AB InBev and you want to read Heineken, do you really have to start at page 1 and get through all the way to the end? Like,
right.
I don't really actually think you do.
Right.
I think you got to read the stuff that really matters.
Right. What are some of the more easy 10Ks to read? Like, what are what
Omega Flex?
Omega Flex?
That is awesome.
All right, I got to read that
man,
one.
That's a hell of a 10K. You know, I think, man, I wish I knew to prepare for this one.
I didn't even have this one in there.
No, I've answered this on Twitter before. Like, Simpress wrote a really good, or writes a really good one. That business is harder to understand than some. I think Booking writes a really good one. Facebook's is excellent. Those are sort of the ones that come up. Like, A.O. Smith, I think, writes a pretty good one.
Okay.
You know who had the answer to this that people should reference is like Bluegrass Capital had an interview.
Okay.
And he goes through and he recommends like 10 different companies that he thinks that people should study as sort of like an MBA. The answers he gives in that I think is probably a pretty good start.
Okay. Perfect.
But yeah, Omega Flex, like if people ask, like, because you know what I like about them? So that what they do, they do like tubes, they something that they own the patent on enhances the ability of a, it's not a plumber, but for lack of a better term, let's call him a plumber, to connect the tube. And the amount of work that saves, the time that they save, is how they price their product.
Okay.
And that's why their margins are so good and whatnot. And right. It's not even IP protected. It's just like a better mousetrap that people can't
seem to figure out.
Yeah, I'm almost certain I'm right on that. I mean, yeah. Maybe it's IP protected, but anyway, they explain that very well in the 10K. So I thought that it was so well written that I called them to say that I really enjoyed reading it. I think they thought I was insane.
I think that meant a lot to them, Bill.
Maybe.
So
some corporate nerd was like, "Thank you."
So what industries do you just not touch with a 10-foot pole, or are there any?
I mean, well, one I've avoided and probably to my detriment is shipping. I mean, those guys, I think, really called the capital cycle correct and then got a little bit lucky with this COVID stuff. But, I mean, they were right. I think they were right for the right reasons and then got some optionality on top of it. Cruise lines, I'm not really interested in. I've just gotten less intrigued by businesses that are using all of the cash flow from operations to buy new equipment. It's just not something that I really am interested in, no matter how cheap it is.
Right. Or even just, you know, maybe not even buying new equipment, but just kind of going off what you said, just to keep themselves operating. They have to reinvest all that just to keep the lights on. What are your thoughts? You know, and this is just, you know, maybe we get another, you know, meta question here that I didn't prepare you for, because, you know, it's just kind of how it rolls. But what are your thoughts on the idea of, you know, letting these airlines fail and letting them go through Chapter 11 like other companies and this whole,
bring
you know,
me into this. Now we're getting into politics. I think that the policy decision to try to save jobs and avoid good jobs going to unemployment is one that I support and definitely did support early.
Right.
You know, how this all sort of plays out, I don't really know. Long term, you have to let indebted businesses fail. I mean, we can't, we've got to let capitalism work.
Right.
I can understand the policy decision of trying to not create restructuring risk on the middle of a supply and demand shock that's simultaneously happening. I just don't know that if I were making the decisions, I would want.
Hey guys, it's Brandon. It was about this time where Bill and I's Skype feed got cut off. So we just reconnected real quick and I had Bill pick up right where he left off. Thanks again for tuning in this far and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
All right, go ahead. Just keep riffing.
I just don't think I don't know that you want to have if you are going to not allow equity to pay their employees, then they are going to lay people off.
Yeah.
They're not just going to surrender their equity value right now. Now, you know, the arguments for, well, make them issue equity. I think that's right. I just think right now we were trying to get through. I mean, a period where equity issuance really wasn't possible.
Yeah.
The debt markets really weren't all that open And I think policymakers did a reasonable job at sort of short-term staving off systemic risk. There's still a ton of risk. I mean, the idea that these businesses are going to come out of this unscathed is crazy to me. So, and, you know, then I don't think that we can bail any of them out. I mean, then you got to let the system go.
Yeah. So what industries are you most excited about, you know, looking out, let's say, post-COVID? Obviously, you know, PPE, that's a fun answer. But what other industries do you think present the best, you know, runways in terms of, you know, revenue expansion, margin expansion over the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. The industry that I am most interested in but haven't done the work to have an opinion on is semiconductors.
Okay.
And then, I mean, I think travel – I think that travel is the one to watch. It's the one I understand. I think that there are some really, really good assets in there, and I think that it has just gotten waxed. And, you know, the names that I am watching are Booking, Mountain – or Vail Resorts, Disney, Transdiamond, Heiko. I mean, those are sort of the five that I'm like, I check a lot. I'm a Formula One, Live Nation, like all that stuff makes a lot of sense to me to do work on.
Have you looked at any one of the popular themes, at least around FinTwit, has been the sports clubs play?
Yeah.
That whole Man U, MSG, all that.
Batter, the Braves.
Yeah,
I mean, look, I think it makes a lot of sense. The tough thing for me is that's like that falls into the category. The Braves to me are like almost certainly undervalued. I don't know when they're going to be sold, and you can get some of it through some of the other exposure in like I'm pretty sure a lot of it still resides in Formula One. I need to relook at the reattribution of assets, but I just. That to me, it's like tough because it's one of those, when does price start? Like, I don't know what they're worth.
Yeah.
I just know that a lot of rich guys pay a lot of money for them.
Yeah.
And I know they probably will continue to.
Yeah. And I just know as a Nats fan, I will probably take the short end of that trade and short the Braves if I could.
Yeah. Well, that's fine. You know, they're the one of the only public ones, right?
I know. So. I know. It's cool though. It's really cool. Looking back, you've gotten all this experience. You've come from, you know, doing a franchise, franchise job, you know, trying to do that, doing your options trading, taking a shot, managing money, you know, now your portfolio manager. Looking back on all that experience, if you could go back in time and kind of talk to the younger Bill Brewster about investing, you know, what are some pieces of advice you would give him starting out?
Well, I wish that I had found the passion earlier in life because I definitely would have started anywhere. You got to find people. I would start out to the if possible on the buy side, or maybe an investment bank, and work as hard as I possibly could to get to the buy side as fast as humanly possible. If you are really interested in this stuff, distressed debt is super interesting. I am really grateful for the credit training that I had. I would not have even known that that would be a path to take. I'm pretty sure Ben Graham was a credit analyst. But, you know, get involved. Participate on Twitter. Like, you know, if you're young, cite stuff from filings. Don't cite stuff from Seeking Alpha. That's bullshit. You know, but like for real, do like primary work, put your work out there, get involved in some accounts that have, you know, like the guys from Ensemble. Those guys are really, really smart.
Yep.
Engage with them in a way that is value added to them, and they will engage with you and you will learn a lot from them.
What are some specific things that you've taken from the credit side that have helped you as an equities analyst? Because one of the things I'm always interested in is learning more and more about the credits. Because I came from just equities and I don't really have any exposure to credit, and I wish I did, and I want to learn more. So like how can one learn more about the credit side? Like, are there books and stuff like that? And then what are some skills that have actually transferred to equities that you now use?
Well, I mean, one was a lot of equity guys learned what covenants were the past month.
That's a good point.
So, you know, and look, I'm not like perfect at it at all. I mean, when it comes to notes, right, my background is senior lending, bank debt. So a lot of the times I have to reach out to guys that I think are from debt backgrounds. Like one guy, Skellicap, I try to, you know, follow his feed and see who's he's talking to and ask those guys questions. But at least I think I have a better sense of maybe the questions to ask. I mean, you know, liquidity, when the shit hits the fan, liquidity matters a lot.
100%. Yep.
And I don't think that people appreciate liquidity day to day. It's something that working on workout credits really helped me appreciate. And it also made me appreciate how much people are willing to overlook a short-term leverage issue as long as the business is doing the right thing and liquidity's there. That said, I mean, you never know who the holders on the other side are. They could push you into, you know, a bankruptcy, but most incentives are for people to work together to continue a relationship. So, you know, I do think that like the way watching how our group worked, the big clients do tend to get preferential treatment. People's bonuses do depend on outstandings. Outstandings are driven by big client relationships.
Right.
So, you know, it helps. To have seen that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, awesome. Now, I want to talk about the story of you getting dunked on by Charlie Munger.
Oh, Charlie.
So for those that aren't familiar, take us through that whole story, because I just love this visual and kind of how you tell it.
No, I had asked him a couple years ago about the airline investment, and then, you know, I've kind of gone back and forth, and I was there this year, and I didn't know what I was going to ask him, and I figured, well, I'll ask him about quality investing, because I've started to think that the market actually perpetually undervalues the really great companies, and I think, I'm not sure, but I think that's what Acri thinks too. I mean obviously that's just riffing, but I get that sense. And so I asked him, and I didn't phrase it right. I said, I added the U.S. and the way that he is. I mean, if you ask him any question that has a, like, just a little bit of wiggle room in it, you know, he ended up saying, well, the best companies are in China. And, you know, eventually you'll realize because I'm right and you're smart or something like that. And it was I'm really pissed that I gave him that out. Because I thought it was a pretty good question.
Yeah.
It just wasn't phrased right.
Yeah. So how do you think he might have asked or might have answered it if you asked it the way you wanted to?
I think he would have said yes.
Okay.
I think he would have said that if you have long hold periods, focusing on the quality of the business is way, way, way more important than focusing on the multiple.
Yeah.
And his value investors are cod fishermen was the quote that resonated with me over the past year or so. And that's what I wanted him to sort of expand on a little bit is, you know, are you saying that people are too focused on multiples and that they should focus on the quality of businesses? And that's really the question that I was asking. And
yeah,
I think you would have said you're closer to learning what I've tried to teach you for my entire life.
Love it. All right. So, you know, we're going to kind of come up here and kind of wrap it up. So where can people go to find more about you, Bill?
I'm on Twitter all the time, at Bill Brewster SCG. And that'll lead you where you need to go. But you can always contact me through that.
And talk to them about the Value After Hours podcast.
Oh, yeah. My boy Toby and Jake, or boys. Yeah, that's been fun, man. So it's on the Acquires podcast, and it's part of Tobias Carlyle's feed. And we sort of put together something that we thought that we'd want to listen to, and it turns out other people do too.
There you go. So how did that start? How did you get connected with Toby?
At Berkshire.
Okay.
I went to a happy hour that he was at, and I got talking to him, and I was like, man, I love Deep Value. I think Deep Value is one of the best books written on investing. And then we just started hanging out, and it became a friendship. And then, you know, what, 3-4 years later, he said, "Do you want to do a podcast with me?" And I was like, "Yeah, dude, I would love to." You know, I don't know why I'm the one that warrants having one, but thank you. And that got pretty good traction. And he and I have talked throughout the years, and he came to me with the Value After Hours idea. And I said, "Yeah, man, I'll give this thing a shot." And it's working out nicely, I think, for everybody.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've been a fan of it, listening to it, and
someday maybe we'll make money doing it, but it's been fun.
Someday, yeah, you know, of course. But you know, I like that you guys are going live and you're doing kind of like the live YouTube stuff, so you can see the comments and all that. I think that's really cool, just kind of really getting interactive. One question I do have that I ask everybody on the show is, if you could have dinner with one person, past or the present, who would it be and why?
Probably Munger.
Munger, okay.
Yeah, because he's a beast. You know, I mean, it's just like he's so sharp, still. He's done more for my life. And look, I love Buffett. I mean, I'd name my third kid after the guy. So, I mean, I'm all in. But I think that Buffett is a unique case of, like, Buffett's the Jordan of investing. Right. Like, he had the talent and the drive that no one else had.
Yep.
Munger, I think, he's naturally has a much, much bigger brain than I do. But I think that the way that he could riff on life would be much more interesting to talk to and about. And I, you know, he would be the one.
Yeah. It seems like Charlie's kind of more the Ben Franklin, where it's just all encompassing breadth of knowledge.
Yeah, and look, I mean, you know, everything that you hear about the guys that have lunch with Buffett, like, they rave about him. So I'm not – it's just, if you give me two, it's those two.
Yep, yep.
But 100%. I had to pick one.
Yeah, 100%. Awesome. Well, Bill, thanks so much for coming on the show. I had a blast, and, you know, the time went by fast. I look forward to releasing it. I know others are going to learn a lot. And definitely follow Bill if you're not already following him, because he puts out some great content. So stay safe, stay healthy, and thanks for coming on the show.
All right, thanks for having me.